Okay, everybody, let's settle down. It's all yours, guys. Have at it.
All right. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome back. I hope everybody had an opportunity to drive around town, go to the marble quarry, go up to the grave, and pay the traditional homage up there. I think it was nice to have a period of time where we could just settle down a little. We're going to be moving into the fifth step now, but what came to me over the last couple of hours is an experience I had at a workshop years and years ago that was really revelatory to me. I was at this event called the Brooklyn Roundup, right? It was, 7 or 8 years ago. It was a number of speakers, number of 1 hour speaker slots were set up. And a good friend of ours from Austin, Texas, Katie, gets up and she's talking about relationships. And she does this. Okay, everyone, be honest and everybody please participate. I want participation in this. And she goes, every single person in here that's married, raise your hand. Now there's like 600 people there. So I'm telling you, maybe 60 people raise their hand. And right away, my eyebrows go up because something like 51% of adults in America are married. Something like that. That's the statistic, right? So right away, we're deviating from the norm. We're at like 10%. But it even got worse after that. She said, okay, everybody in here that's been divorced, raise your hand. And like 350 people raised their hand out of like 600. And then it got worse. She goes, everybody that's been divorced 3 or more times, please raise your hand. And at least 200 people raised their hand. Now, I got it. We've done a really poor job with this relationship thing, with the intimate relationships. We're challenged with that. And the sex inventory says that, we need an overhauling. So in the last session, we went over a number of things. It asks us then to put an ideal together for our future sex conduct. Who do we want to be when we show up at the next party? And we're supposed to develop those characteristics and ask God to mold us toward those characteristics. And I think it's really possible for us to get to a place where we're really healthy. Because in an unrecovered state, we've pretty much rendered ourselves permanently single. You know what I mean? And for one reason or another, unless it's a real bizarre relationship. So a lot of work, I think, really has to go into that. A lot of work. Like placing the welfare of the other ahead of our own is a good guidepost, That helps a lot. Being respectful and being transparent and all that. And all that stuff came hard for me. It's been a struggle. It's been a struggle not to avoid uncomfortable things by lying through omission. It's not a direct lie. Well, you should have told me, So there's been a lot of those growing pains, with me, but it's an area where we're really gonna get dividends. If we put the work in, we're really gonna get dividends. Cause I truly believe you attract what you are. And if you're a spiritual, supportive, transparent kind of a person, that's what you tend to attract. So, just
can I say something?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Well, because it's such an interesting thing, at least to me, because I've been married for 38 years, and I was married for almost 7 years before getting sober, and I met my wife in a bar over a 8-ball of cocaine. It was hers. And I was very attracted to her, and And a few months later, we went on a trip to Mexico and drank something out of a coconut and ended up on a boat that went out to international waters. And an Austrian merchant marine read in Spanish what he swears was a wedding ceremony. And we don't speak Spanish, so we don't know what we agreed to on that boat. But the point I would make, and it was almost seven years later when I got sober, and her sobriety date's 10 days after mine. But we stayed married, but we struggled. And I think that there are a lot of relationships that don't survive recovery because we are different people, and what brought us together won't necessarily keep us together. And the things that brought us together, and so we had to figure out a little bit, like I talked about earlier, are we compatible? Not do we care about each other. We also were parents to a daughter, 5 years old, when we got sober. But at one point, and we were really struggling, 4 or 5 years into our recovery. And you know, I'm coming out here to AA, and I'm seeing that there's more to be had. And I think Connie likewise was seeing that from her own perspective. So we're home one day, and kind of to Chris's point, she says, what would you like? I'm complaining, I'm sure, about something. She says, what do you want this to look like? What do you want this relationship to look like? And I said, well, I want us to be honest and open and transparent and emotionally intimate. And I'd like you to go first, please. And I keep waiting for somebody else to see if it's safe for me to go in the water, because I'm not used to doing that. And so it took us a good while, and I'm just grateful. I often kid, I haven't been, I've been married to 3 different women. They were just all Connie. And she's been married to multiple versions of me over the last 38 years, because we change and grow, hopefully. And I think what we found, and we're quite different people in a lot of ways. But you find a way to respect those differences, and that compatibility doesn't mean you see everything the same. For us, it meant we have enough security to allow the other person to be who they are. And we encourage that of each other and for each other, rather than be so insecure that I need to. We were joking when I left. She said, don't have fun without me. Because that used to be the way things were. Don't get caught having fun without me. That's somehow disloyal to the marriage. And now she's hoping I'm having a wonderful time, and I'm hoping that she is. So go ahead, Chris.
Thanks, Steve. So okay, we've put together this list. Hopefully we've had some guidance from sponsors or spiritual advisors or book studies or whatever. We gain all this information from different places. But honestly and thoroughly, we've put together a resentment inventory. We've put together a fear inventory. And we've put together a sex conduct inventory. And we've done the absolute best job we can. And it gets to a point where you just kind of know it's done. You might be able to continue to add stuff, but you kind of know it's done. Now it's time to find the right person to share this inventory with. Now my first experience with a four step, It was in 1990, and this is Joe and Charlie, pre anything. The guidance that you would get in meetings back then, if you asked, how do you do a four step? Somebody in the back would go, kid, you do a four step with a pencil. And everybody would laugh. And that was what you would get in my area for advice. So what I did was I went to a lot of 12-step meetings where it was the four step. I figured out where four step meeting is going to be over here next week and over here. And I went to a ton of four step meetings. I had done a life story in treatment, and I kind of put this thing together without really any guidance. And really what it was a confessional exercise. It was, I was saying that, yeah, these are the mistakes that I've made. These are the faults I've made. These are the dirty little secrets that I have. These are some patterns that I've discovered in my personality, much to my chagrin. And I had this thing, I still have it. It's like in one font. It's like a novel in 2 pages. And what it was a bizarre confessional life story-esque kind of a thing. And it was time to meet up with my sponsor and do my fifth step. And what I did was, I made arrangements. I made an appointment with him, and he liked to multitask. So he said, we're going to do it at the park while I'm walking my dogs, right? So we took a long walk through Lewis Morris Park down in Morristown while I read this stuff. And here's what the confessional, being honest aspect of a fifth step did for me. What it did was I went into this thing with my head held low. I truly believed that I was a scumbag. I mean, if you let all the people down that I let down, if you made all the mistakes I made, if you did the crazy things in blackouts, if your families blew up and you'd come to in jail and all this kind of stuff happened, and you're normal, you would probably have the same feelings I had. Like, I really thought, you know, there's something really, really differently wrong about me. And I start reading this stuff, and he's just listening, and he's walking the dogs, and I finally get done, and I look up at him, and he goes, huh, well, that's not so bad. And I kind of got a little pissed. What do you mean that's not so bad? You know, this is stuff that had been crushing my spirit for years. That's not so bad. We can work with that, he said. And he saw the look of puzzlement on my face, right? And this is what he said, and I'll never forget it. He said, Chris, this is what I think your alcoholism was like. First of all, I think you were alcoholic before you started drinking. Picture a campfire with like red coals, you know, the coals or the embers are just red hot. And you come along with a can of gasoline and you throw it on those embers and all of a sudden the flames just jump up in the air and burn everything around. He goes, that's the way I think your alcoholism was. I think you were smoldering, and when you started drinking alcohol, all of a sudden the flames went up and they burnt you and they burnt people around you and there was a lot of damage. There's no question about that. But I want you to know that you're making a serious effort right now to change. You're making a serious effort to move away from the type of person you were and take responsibility for a lot of this stuff. Then he said, lighten up on yourself a little bit. And that was my very first experience with a fifth step. And I went to that park with my head held low. And on the way home, something had changed. Something had changed. And, you know, I had a feeling that maybe I'm going to be okay. And it was a wonderful feeling. I then get involved with people who really had some deep working experience with the text Alcoholics Anonymous. I got inspired through recordings at first, and I got to meet some really serious people. And the next inventory I did, I could honestly say it was a big book inventory. It was a list of resentments with the columns. It wasn't life story-esque. And I started to learn some things about myself. Now, the confessional life story, I already knew all this stuff. There was no discovering deep chunks of truth about myself in that exercise. There was spiritual virtue and a real benefit in doing that type of thing with my sponsor, but it was nothing like my experience when I started to do the inventory the way it's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember, you know, I was inspired by tapes and some people, and I went back to my sponsor with my inventories. And he wanted to know what they were. He'd been doing fifth steps with people forever. And he's like, what are all those columns? You know, what is this? And I said, look, you know, this is the way I had some instruction and this is the way I did it. And I'd appreciate it if you'd just bear with me. And we did it. We did that, that inventory. And I read all of everything that I wrote. Everything that I wrote, I read. And it was, it really was transformational. Some of the promises after step four are really impactful, and step five are really impactful. And, you know, I can honestly say that, I believe my spiritual awakening started right, you know, three, four, and five was the beginning of a huge spiritual change in me. And again, all this stuff is remarkable to me, that they came up with this inventory, that Bill came up with this inventory, laying in bed or, you know, whatever the story was. And the economy of it, you know, I'm telling you, I've known people that have been in therapy for long, long, long periods of time. And when they did a big book inventory, they said, I've never seen this stuff. I never understood this. You know, I never had, you know, this is amazing. And so it's really remarkable just how powerful and just how effective these inventories are. And when we read them, for me, it was the first time I was really being transparent and honest with another person. I had no facade. You know, going into those fifth steps. I wasn't trying to make you like me. I wasn't trying to say it a way that would, you know, keep you from thinking I was small. I mean, I read it the way it was written, and that was the way, these workshops described, the process. And I did it that way. And I got to tell you, the people in the rooms, the people that I was fellowshipping at that time, saw an enormous change, probably more than I did. Right after that, I started sponsoring a ton of people, the craziest lunatics you've ever seen in your life. You know, because there was an apparent change in the way I was sharing, the things I was discussing, and how I was expressing my experience in these meetings, and it really was huge. The alcoholic leads a double life. You know, that's an understatement. We lead multiple double lives. I'm trying to be this with you and this with you, and there was something I was very uncomfortable with, was being myself. Because I didn't really think much of myself. I mean, believe me, I was toxically selfish, but I didn't have a high opinion of myself. So I thought it better to, you know, create a facade. So all that stuff started breaking down around this time, and I started to become Chris. And, you know, I look back, I've probably done a dozen four and fives over the years. There was a period of time I did it every year. Then there was a period of time it stretched out to about four. I think the last time I did a full-blown series through the steps was about 3 years ago. And I know what the warning signs are when I need to revisit this stuff, when 10 and 11 hasn't been doing the whole job. I start to become cranky, critical. I start to judgmental. You know, those are all warning signs that I need to dig back into this inventory work and go over it again. But I've had amazing experiences with these fifth steps. I want to share for a minute, and then I'll turn it back to Steve. I want to share on my experience hearing fifth steps. I've heard several hundred at the very least, and I want to tell all of you, we're all the same. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, there's differences in these inventories. There's different things that we did. There's different ways that we've seen things. But as a category, We alcoholics are pretty predictable. You're going to do a fifth step with me. There ain't going to be any surprises for me in that fifth step. You know what I mean? You may think there will be, but I've pretty much heard it all. A couple of psychopaths did a fifth step with me, like real serious, you know, criminal deviants. And those were disturbing fifth steps to hear. But, you know, the traditional Alcoholics Anonymous fifth step is, I like you more after you've shared your fifth step than I did before you shared it. You know, every time. Because what we're doing is we're exposing how we fell short. And we all fall short. Every day we fall short. And I would much rather be around somebody that can be honest and transparent about their falling short than somebody who's just going to bulldoze past that and go on to make the next mistake. You know what I mean? So that's been my experience with fifth steps. The thing that I've done probably more in the last 10 years is because I believe there's an economy with all this stuff. I'm not okay with you showing up to my house with 700 pages. Okay? There's no way to do 700 pages if you follow these instructions. There's an economy to these instructions. So, and another thing that I do is that sometimes we have a tendency when we're reading a fifth step to give you the story first, read the thing in the fifth step, and then tell you a little bit more about that situation. And a lot of times that comes from ego. That doesn't really come from spirit. And I'll try to cut that short because I think there's impact in sharing it the way it's written. You know, is it appropriate to let somebody have a long talk? In many cases, absolutely. Absolutely. But there's also an impact in hammering what's being written in the fifth step over and over again. I was selfish. I was dishonest. I was self-seeking. I was frightened. I was selfish. I was dishonest. I was self-seeking. I was frightened. I was selfish. I was frightened. I was dishonest. Over and over again, there's an impact in sharing that with another person that I think is transformational. You know, all these steps are spiritual in nature, and all these steps prepare us for the next ones. And if we're honest and we're thorough and we're diligent about this work, I've just seen such change in myself, and I've seen such change in people I've worked with this process. You know, and I'm going to pass it over to you, Steve.
Thanks, Chris. You know, I'm comforted always when someone I respect shares my views. You know, it gives me, and Chris just talked about things that that I really believe in strongly, and some of it has been has evolved over time, which I'll get to in just a second. And I'm just going to talk for about 5 minutes on this and give it back to Chris to lead us into step 6 and 7 because you covered it so well. But it, you know, I was in a meeting and it was a fourth and fifth step meeting. And usually, you know, when you go to a fourth and fifth step workshop, let's say it's an hour long, you usually get 55 minutes of fourth step and then 5 minutes of fifth step. We give it short shrift a lot of the time, yet it's such a critical thing. You know, the book says that we must be entirely honest with somebody if we are to live long and happily. I mean, that's all that's at stake. If you want a long, happy life, this is probably going to be a requirement. And, you know, my sponsor, Frank, he said, Steve, somebody needs to know everything about you. But not everybody needs to know everything about you. And, you know, so there are things that are best kept, not secret, but private. And not now, as I've been sober longer and have confidants. I mean, I overshared in the last session, right? I'll talk about just about anything, right? But to put stuff on the table in a way that's useful and helpful. But I went through a period where I talked more during your fifth step than you did. And man, and I realized I, you know, it didn't take me but about 10 years to realize I was doing it. But I realized how egoic that was and how self-centered that was. It wasn't my intention, but I, you know, now I really want to honor what someone has done and you have done that work. And the book says, you know, I want to read these last couple of paragraphs because this is not about the fifth step. This is about the fourth step. And it says, if we've been thorough, you know, we've written down a lot. We've listed and analyzed our resentments. We've begun to comprehend their futility and fatality. We've commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We've begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. We've listed people we've hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten it out. If you have already made a decision and an inventory, your grosser handicaps, you've made a good beginning. That being so, you will have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. That's how I show up at the fifth step, in theory. In theory, I have begun to see the futility and fatality of life if I'm living. And I have got that list of people. I have arrived at some level of willingness to try to make right what I can. And I have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about myself. I keep trying to tell people what they swallowed and digested when they're doing their fifth step, right? I was interrupting that process. And now what I want to hear, the humility of the fifth step, is for me to come tell you what I discovered about me. Man, yet this is me. And there certainly are things that we might weigh in and comment about in an effort to try to be helpful, but not hijack that process by turning myself into a junior psychiatrist, you know. And my job is not to show up with all the answers. I'm just another AA guy tripping down the road making the same mistakes, and I'll put undue pressure on myself to solve your problem, and if I don't have an answer for it, I'll make something up. And I just want to, you know, I've just, over the last few years, really been able to back off that a little bit and just honor what somebody's done. I'm sitting in a meeting, having that fourth and fifth step meeting, and a newer guy working on his fourth step, being as honest and earnest as he could be, said, I don't know why this is necessary, talking about the fifth step. He said, I've got this, I know more about me than anybody. And I realize, as I'm sitting there, I think to myself, I know more about me than anybody, but I often misinterpret the information. And so, and when I say it out loud to somebody else, I tend to have a different experience than when I'm having the conversation in my head. And it often comes out differently than I was thinking it when I begin to share it with somebody. So, it's just been critical. And it says we pocket our pride, illuminating every nook and cranny. My pride will keep me, you know, I can come to something like this or any of us, you know, I can share so much with you guys that you will think, man, I can't believe Steve is willing to talk about that. And then I might have that thing tucked around in back that I didn't put on the table. You don't know that. I have, you know, hidden, I've kept my secret safe by appearing to be open and honest. And what I have said has been accurate, but the thing that will get me is what I keep behind the curtain. The secret. And the secret, in my experience, is more dangerous than the information I'm keeping secret. It's the fact that I have a secret that tends to block me off. From 15 years sober to 18 years sober, I had a secret. And I had something I didn't tell anybody else. And what began to happen to me was I began to feel separate from you and separate from God. I'd be sitting in an AA meeting and a topic would come up. And I'd realize I either can't share on it or I've got to make something up. I got to be a hypocrite. And I usually chose hypocrite, by the way. Whoa. That's Melissa calling me if you're curious. And, you know, it's just this being totally honest with somebody has just been critically important to me. And like Chris said, I come out of that, my experience has been is that when I open myself up, when I, you know, bare myself and bare my soul to you, that we leave that exchange closer rather than that thing I think is going to come between us. It becomes the human and the spiritual connection. And it says in those promises that Chris, referenced, it says that we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We are beginning to get that God consciousness, because that thing between you and me and God, again, is usually those things that I'm keeping too closely held. And, so I just want to honor that fifth step and that sharing, you know, one with another. And when I'm on the receiving end of that, I want to honor that by being what it says, an understanding, closed-mouthed person. The most important, two most important things for me to do in when you come to me with a fourth step to share your fifth step is to listen and keep a confidence. Anything else is a bonus, but listen and keep a confidence and allow you to move on with what you have discovered with those big chunks of truth about yourself that we take into steps 6 and 7. So take us there, Chris.
Thank you, Steve. Okay, so moving into step 6, there's one final exercise that can be described as, you know, finishing up the fifth step. And you know, I missed this for a number of runs through the steps, but I've come to understand kind of its importance because I'm being asked to be contemplative. I'm being asked to do meditation and prayer on a daily basis to really try to intuitively seek within some of these answers. And this returning home exercise, I'm going to read it. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our hearts that we know Him better. So this fifth step really is bringing us closer to God. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we've omitted anything, for we're building an arch through which we shall walk free at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skipped anything? Have we dodged and weaved anything? So I'm supposed to do a review, just a contemplative review of the first 5 steps, so that I'm confident I haven't left anything out as I move into step 6. You know, have I fully conceded to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic? Am I willing to believe, or do I believe that there's a power that I can gain access to that's going to solve my problem? Have I made a decision to really go all the way in with this Alcoholics Anonymous 12-step process? Have I made a decision that this is really the right thing for me in my life? And have I been honest? Have I left anything out of my 4-step? Did I leave out Tallahassee 1978, you know, in a blackout? Did I leave that out? Because the thoroughness is really, really important. Like Steve was saying, if there's something we're holding in the background, that can be corrosive to our spiritual condition as we move through the rest of these steps. It can screw everything up. So being able to, after this returning home, being able to say to myself, I did the best job with the set of tools I had at the time. I've not overtly left any stone unturned. And if something comes to me, something, I'll immediately take care of that with my sponsor. Having that attitude, we then look at step 6. If we can answer to our satisfaction, answer what? The questions in returning home. We then look at step six. We've emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things that we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. So my experience with step six is like this. My character defects, when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, you could see my faults, my character defects. Picture an iceberg, okay? A certain percentage of the iceberg is sticking above water. There was stuff that was visible to me. It was visible to you. It was cutting me off from relationships. You know, I saw that stuff. But over the course of time, what's happened is I've been able to look below the horizon a little bit. I've been able to, the manifestations of self, I started to be able to recognize ones that weren't overt. They didn't impact my relationship with you. They were deeper and they were below the surface. So I think two things are really true. I think that you can do step six and then step seven very, very quickly. And I also think they're a lifetime job. And those two things don't sound compatible together, right? But the attitude I bring to this, do I want to change? Do I want to get better? It's easy to say I want the defects of character that I find objectionable removed. And I'm going to always say yes to that. But sometimes there's deeper stuff. So another thing that should be emphasized is there's prayers all throughout this book. And the first couple of times through the steps, I don't remember saying those prayers. But almost each action step has a prayer. You know, there's the sick man prayer. There's the obvious third step prayer. But here's a sixth step prayer. Seventh step prayer. God, please take these defects of character away. And there's even a prayer in step six. If I'm unwilling to let God remove these defects of character, there's still a path forward, and that path forward is to pray for willingness. You know, it's not unusual. I heard a good friend of ours out in Aspen shared this one time, and he was talking with his sponsor, and you know, he was holding on to some things, you know, like that he wasn't really willing and ready to let go of. And in the conversation, it came out that family, work, and sex life, all right, were things that, you know, he didn't really feel comfortable completely turning over. And then he looked at his inventory, and the inventory was all family, work, and sex conduct. So it's almost like the more fouled up something is, the more we've got fingernails into it. We're gonna hold on and fix it. And this is really a remarkable. These two steps almost look irresponsible to me when I first looked at them. Now let's jump to step seven. When ready, we say something like this: "My Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen." We've all said that prayer in meetings, you know, till the cows come home. Then it says, we have completed step seven. That almost seems irresponsible to me. We've completed step seven. But when I think about it, there's no way to get rid of self without God's help, right? There just seems to be no way to get rid of this selfishness and this self-centeredness without God's help. We must have God's help. And the whole program is about gaining access to God's help. So maybe they mean what they say here. We've completed step 7. You know, end of sentence. And that doesn't mean I don't need to stay aware of these things and continue to do inventory with step 10 and continue to practice these principles in every way they're available and appropriate for me to do so. But I think my job is the willingness and the attitude. I don't think I have the power to remove these defects of character. They're my default settings. They're core pieces of self. And to try to apply self on core pieces of self to rid the self somehow just doesn't make any sense to me today. So I believe I must have God's help. Now, look, this almost looked irresponsible to me. You know, God, take him, you know. But we're asked to move on to another step after this. We're asked to move on to another step after this. That plays, or all this stuff plays a role. All of these steps are, as Steve said, interconnected, intertwined with each other. And they create this awakening in us, a change in personality, a shift in perception that happens when we've gone through these steps that leads to really, really solid recovery. So, you know, I touched briefly on those two steps. Steve, what do you have on 6 and 7 for us?
Well, I don't have much. They're not really very important. And I try to focus on the important steps. But, you know, the truth is we kind of do a drive-by on 6 and 7 because initially, and I think like Chris said, that the, you know, the directions are as simple and straightforward as the two paragraphs that are there. But the spiritual depth and surrender of what I'm committing to in those two paragraphs. You know, Steve Martin used to have a comedy routine, and it was called How to Be a Millionaire. He said, okay, first you get $1 million. Right? And that's what, yeah, but Steve, how did you get the million? And that's what here, so I think that this is as simple kind of as that, but there's so much to it, and it is really kind of doubling down on the unmanageability talked about in the first step. You know, it could be I'm powerless over alcohol, and my defects of character are unmanageable. We say with regard to alcohol, the book says that the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that one day he'll control and enjoy his drinking. And I would say often, unconsciously, because I'm spiritually asleep, that my great obsession is that one day I'll control and enjoy my defects of character. Just like alcohol, where I wanted to do just enough to get from alcohol what I want, but not suffer the pains of it. I want to indulge, be self-indulgent around some defects of character in a way to serve my purpose, but not, you know, I'm powerless over that. I don't have the necessary power to manage the defect. So I am, when I arrive here, you know, 6 and 7 are kind of the now what steps, you know? I've done that inventory. I've done that self-examination. I have arrived at 6 and 7 with more information about me than I've ever had. And the question becomes, now what? Now that you have discovered these things about you, are you really willing to change? And kind of like I was kidding earlier, I'm willing to change, but I want to dictate what the change looks like. My sponsor Don kids about that he got here, and and he his interpretation, if you will, and misapplication was, what would a spiritual dawn look like now? Now that I'm here, how would I, and it's interesting to me. This is another one of the big bait and switch moments in Alcoholics Anonymous. So be careful again if you're new. Because in the sixth step, as Chris read it, it says that we emphasize willingness as being indispensable. We're now ready to let God remove from us all things which we have admitted are objectionable. And that's kind of like, that's kind of like me playing God again, right? Here's a list of defects, and I'm ready that you should take these. I got four over here that I've decided I'd really like you to, I want to keep playing over here with these. When I get to the seventh step, it says that I'm ready now that you should have all of me, good and bad, which implies, number one, that I don't know which is which. I don't get to be in charge of that. I'm putting all the chips on the table. I was going to use, I used to have an analogy of a yard sale, but now it's on, you're doing it on eBay or Etsy or whatever. But when my wife and I moved 7 years ago from a home, a 2,600 square foot home, to a 1,270 square foot condominium, we were downsizing, right? And that's what we're doing here. I'm downsizing. And when we're downsizing, we went through that house and we identified those things we were willing to get rid of. In fact, some things were old and in the way and no longer useful, and we want to be rid of this. And maybe even make room for some new stuff that might be better. And so, using the yard sale analogy, I'm taking all of this stuff out of the house. We put it out in the yard for them to come by on Saturday morning. Everything I've decided we're willing to be rid of. But when they come over for the yard sale and they're picking around through my stuff, I've then got to say, you know what? Go on in the house. Take anything in there you need. And I'm really fond of that recliner and the big screen, But take anything you need that's going to make me, that stand in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And man, that's another one of those do with me as you will moments in AA. That's a double down on that third step prayer. Oh, here I am. You go to a restaurant and say, bring me what you think I'd like. You ever go, I used to get a haircut. But when you go get your hair done, you tell them what you want it to look like when you leave. You don't say, hey, do with me as you will. No, because that's too important to me. And when I do that, when I spiritually say, do with me as you will, there's a fear of, what am I going to look like when you're done? What are you going to leave me with? Will I be able to operate? I'm not used to operating with that. I got some tools here that they're troublesome, but I'm familiar with them. So that level of surrender that says, really, do with me as you will. And it says, in the 12 and 12, it talks about the fact, since God, that's where it says, and I won't say it's misquoted, but I think misapplied sometimes, it says the only step that we work 100% is the first step. Well, really, it's the first half of the first step. The only thing I can measure in Alcoholics Anonymous is when I had my last drink. I can quantify that. That's a physical, space of time between June the 29th is the last time I had a drink and today. But my spiritual condition is all over the board at any given time. And so when I arrive here, it says that God has given me this 100% freedom from alcohol so far. And why can't you do that on these other things? And part of the, and it says it's the riddle of our existence. But one of the reasons it says is because that I was beat into this state of submission with alcohol, where I was willing to give it up 100%. But everything else that we've got is a God-given instinct that's outgrown its usefulness. It says the measure of my defects of character are the difference between God's intended use and my misuse of these God-given instincts. So there can't be 100%, you know, all of this desire for sex, society, and security, which are God-given. I'm always going to be somewhere on the dial. And I'm just trying to do, you know, hoping that I'm growing, continuing to grow along spiritual lines where I'm a little more toward God's intended use more often than not. And the willingness that, you know, it says in here, it says in the third step that willingness is the key. It says here that that I've got to find the willingness. And again, you know, I told you I was 18 years sober before I looked up dilemma. Well, that same, you know, since long as I had that dictionary out, I looked up willingness as well. And one of the descriptions of willingness was doing that which I would not do as a matter of course. Now that makes perfect sense to me. There is not a thing AA has asked me to do that I was just about to do before I got here. There's everything in those 12 steps is counterintuitive to the character that I showed up with. Because I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous with a defective character. I know my character's defective because it creates defects of character. And that means that I was living life and life was being run through the prism of a character that's defective and it is producing these defects that we found in the fourth and fifth step. And for me, I have to be careful, again, not to confuse the behavior for the defect. The behavior is the outward external evidence of the defect. But the defect is internal. And how do I, you know, it says that God won't render us white as snow without my cooperation. So I got to cooperate. God's got the power, but I got to cooperate. And you guys have been telling me that since I got to AA. You've been saying that we act our way into right thinking. We don't think our way into right acting. And let's say I go to the supermarket when I'm brand new in AA you know, there he or she is in that express lane with too many items. And I know there are too many items because I have counted them. And I got no choice but to snatch him or her up and make a scene and send them over into the right aisle. And you guys say, Steve, that's just, you know, that's bad behavior, man. That's just not the way we want to act here. So next time, I'm there and there he or she is again and they still got too many items because I'm still counting them. And by the way, I count a six pack as six items, so you know. And this time I don't say a word. I stand there in line, I don't say a word, but I'm about to implode from not saying a word, right? I'm biting my lip, there's blood trickling down, but I don't say a thing. Now I'm not free of that defective character. But I'm not causing any collateral damage with that. I'm not acting on that defect. That in itself is an act of humility. To act different than I feel is an act of humility. And humility and character building are the two key things about step seven that the 12 and 12 talks about. And if I do that often enough, if I go to the store and I stand in that line and don't respond to the person with too many items, one day I will find myself there and not even count the items. And if that ever happens, I'll report back to you. But you know, it is so that's how I participate in this. I have to realize again, and it's the common theme that my problems are all internal. And that defective character that produces these defects is treated spiritually by these 12 steps, these steps that are spiritual in their nature that Chris read earlier this weekend. That if practice as a way of life will give me that 100% sobriety, expel the obsession to drink, but leave me happily and usefully whole, not grudgingly whole, not the guy in line that's still counting the items and feeling, but happily and usefully whole. And, you know, it's again those demands. you know, 6 and 7 into 12 and 12, 7 is where it talks about the fact that my demands, that's where it says we all know the difference in a simple request and a demand. And I'll tell you a story. When I was, I went to Toronto to a weekend retreat not unlike this, right? And I'm sitting up here with a friend of mine, Mary Jane Roy. You might know Mary Jane. But anyway, we're doing the deal, and we break for lunch, just like we did here today. And we were out at a restaurant, and I'm sitting at a table with about eight people, a round table with eight people, and they came and they took our order. And I ordered a cheeseburger. And the guy next to me, I noticed, ordered a club sandwich, and then they went around and took everybody's order, right? And a little while later, they brought our food out. And they gave me a cheeseburger. And they gave the guy next to me a cheeseburger. And I see him start eating this cheeseburger. This is your Zen moment for the weekend if you've been waiting on it. They give this guy this cheeseburger. And I said, hey man, I thought you ordered a club sandwich. This is unbelievable. Listen to what he said. He said, I did. But they brought me a cheeseburger. That's it. I said, brother, you don't have to live like that. And I'm serious. I said, we can get you a club sandwich. And I'm standing up calling the people over. And he's going, Steve, no, I'm good, man. And understand, he just wasn't eating the damned old cheeseburger because that's what life had served him. He was fine with the cheeseburger. Now, he had every right, if he had wanted to say, you know what, I ordered a club sandwich, would you guys mind getting me? And they would have gotten him the club sandwich, and, 10, 15 minutes, he would have gotten that. And that would have been perfectly okay. But wasn't his life better in that moment because he was okay with the cheeseburger? And see, I will tell you, metaphorically speaking, I go through life ordering a club sandwich and getting a cheeseburger, and it ain't okay. In fact, I go through life waiting on you to get my order right, and I don't even know I've placed an order. I go through life with that disappointment. That defective character is seeing what's missing all the time. And it says, living a life of unmet demands will leave me in a state of continual disturbance. And I don't want to be continually disturbed. When that character, this character development is that psychic change, is that internal change that we've been talking about. Because the answer is always inside. It's my last story before I'm done for this afternoon, but there's a Sufi story, and with my accent, I've never felt right telling a Sufi story, so I've changed it to Tennessee redneck. So you got an old boy outside, just outside is his front door, looking in the grass for the keys to his pickup truck. He's lost the keys to his pickup truck. And he's crawling around looking for them, and a couple of guys drive by, a couple of buddies of his, and they see him, and they ask him what he's doing, and he says, I've lost the keys to my pickup truck. And as good friends are wont to do, they get out and help him look for the keys. And they're crawling around looking. And pretty soon, some other boys drive by, and before you know it, you got 8 or 10 people crawling around on their hands and knees, painstakingly looking through every blade of grass for the keys to this pickup truck. And finally, one of them asked, they said, where were you when you lost the keys? And he said, I was inside. And they said, well, what are we doing out here? And he said, well, the light's so much better out here. And see, I'm always looking out here. And I will tell my story to you so convincingly that you will help me look. But the keys are inside. His keys were inside the house, but he's out here. The keys to that defective character, to this life that is not in a state of continual disturbance, is internal. And I still get caught up thinking that it's out here. And that is the way I view things, through a character that is defective. My view of life is through that character, through the prism of my alcoholism, through the prism of that self-centeredness. And I get here to 6 and 7, I bring this package to just think what I've learned about me so far, because I continue to learn. But then I go, yeah, man, God, I'm ready. Take it. I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know what you got for me. I don't know how you want to use me. You know? It's like saying, you know, as Chris said earlier, where we talk about we're like actors in a play, and I want to direct the play, but I'm not the director, I'm the actor. It says we are in the world to play the role he assigns. So sometimes my morning prayers, okay, what's my role today? And how would you have me play it? But I keep casting myself in the role of action hero, being in charge. And sometimes I'm just supposed to be, you know, policeman number 3 walking down the sidewalk, not even a speaking part. What's the role you would have me play? And give up assigning myself. And that's what my defects of character do. They are me assigning myself these various roles and how I'm going to work out into the world today. So that's all I got.
That's great. The light's better out here. I love that story. So two stories, and then I'm done for the afternoon. One of them has to do with, you know, when Steve was talking, I was realizing that so much of this is about quelling the disturbance, the inner disturbance. We're learning how not to fight in certain areas in these steps. They're teaching us about learning how to fight. And one of the promises in the 10th step is we stop fighting alcohol or anything else. So I had a favorite TV show in the late 1960s. There might be people old enough to remember this. Do you remember the show Kung Fu? You know, David Carradine, what the story was about was he was a Shaolin priest who had to like split his country, and he was hiding out in the Old West back in the like 1800s or something. And he'd get in all these adventures, but he was a kung fu master, Shaolin priest. So he was like really, really mellow and zen-like, but he could also kick your ass. And there was something very cool about that. And I loved this show. And it was one of the shows that just stayed in my memory over the decades. And about 10 years ago, it came out on DVD. And I said, you know, I'm going to get this. So I got all 3 seasons on DVD. And I watched the show again, and there was this one episode. So Kane is sitting around a campfire with a couple of friends that he's just started traveling with. He's sitting around a campfire talking at night. And all of a sudden these robbers come up and they got their pistols out. And they hold these guys up and they search these guys and they take whatever they want from his 2 buddies, and they search him, and he's got like, he's got like a pouch of herbs or something, and they get disgusted, and then they disappear. They're gone. Now, the 2 guys know about Kane and his abilities, right? And they say, why didn't you do something? You could have taken those guys out. And he said this, I had nothing to defend. And it was like an acid moment for me, revisiting this and watching it. My whole life, I've been defending things that weren't worth defending. My whole life, I'd get in an argument with you about anything. I'd be defending a turd. You know what I mean? Like, it stinks and everybody hates it, but it's my turn, you know? And I'm defending this stuff. And so what these steps do is they get us ready to, you know, stop fighting. Now the next story I want to tell you will lead into steps 8 and 9. Steve said a great quote from the 12 and 12, God will not render us white as snow without our cooperation. So, you know, how then shall I cooperate with the removal of my character defects? Certainly we say the prayer and we're willing and we follow those instructions. But there's got to be a continuance of an attitude. I'll tell you this one story. I was sponsoring this guy, and, you know, he was rough. I lived in this town called Basking Ridge, and it was a bedroom community with professionals, and there was really not a lot of crime except for me and John. And literally, if somebody was walking their dog without a leash, you know, it would make the newspaper. It was one of those places, right? And this guy moves in and shows up in our AA meetings, and it's about 6 months before he could even talk. He was so smashed up. I ended up sponsoring him, of course, but he was so smashed up. He was on pounds of Percocets and alcohol for like a long period of time. He got detoxed and they told him to go to AA and he was in AA. And I started working with him. And he had the willingness. The willingness that's born of desperation. He was desperate. He knew he was going to die. And so he became willing to follow our lead and to follow my suggestions as a sponsor. And one day we're leaving a convenience store and we're heading to a meeting, and we both got coffees at the convenience store because we knew who the coffee maker was at that meeting. And so as we're walking out of this convenience store, I see him do this. He just really, really quick grabs a pack of cigarettes as we're going through the door and puts it in his pocket and we're out. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Did you just steal a pack of cigarettes? And he goes, no. I go, let me rephrase that. Did you grab a pack of cigarettes as we were leaving the store and not pay for them? Yeah. I go, well, that's stealing. He goes, no, they were on the rack in front. I go, what does that mean? He goes, you're a chump if you don't take those. They budget for that. You know, he'd been doing this whole life. He came from the city. And so, you know, all right, sponsor summit. Time for a sponsor summit. You know, we need to talk about this. We had a talk about it, and he became willing to put envelopes together, and to put money in envelopes, and to go back to 20 some convenience stores that he's been doing that. He's been doing that too since he was a kid, and he actually went back out. And he started handing these envelopes and saying, you know, I'm an alcoholic, I'm trying to straighten out my life, I sold, here's some money. And he did that with like 25 convenience stores. And I just want to ask you a question. Do you think he still steals cigarettes? You know, each of these steps just roll into the next one in such a logical sequence. I think the best possible atmosphere to be in for the removal of character defects is to become willing to make amends to the people and institutions those defects of character have harmed, and to actually go make amends to the people in those institutions that those character defects have harmed. And with that, I don't have anything. Okay, we're back. We're over at the, we'll let Malcolm tell us what we're doing. Malcolm, thank you.
Thank you, Chris and Steve. It's an awesome afternoon. We really appreciate where you're going with all of this. We are going straight. Well, first of all, for the Zoom participants, we're going to sign off. We're not going to leave anything up on the Zoom screen. So you'll need to re-sign in to start the evening sessions. The evening session is start at 7:30. Is that correct? Somebody got a schedule in front of them? So we'll sign back on to Zoom at 7:20 or so. And get ready. We're going to have another experiment. We're going to be outside over at the firehouse, and we'll see how that goes. For those of us in person, we're going to go straight out to the front porch right now and line up on the front porch and take our group picture. And anybody who doesn't want to participate, you feel free to stay here. We'll do the usual picture routine, the small people in the front, the tall people in the back, and we'll take the picture. And we'll have a break till 6 o'clock to sit down for the sit-down dinner at 6 o'clock. Thanks, everybody.